Dr. Vickery, I'd like to draw your attention to page 10 of your testimony. At the bottom of the page, you indicate that most passerines that perform flight displays do not conduct these displays in strong wind. Of course, we're not talking about most passerines. We're talking about passerines that breed in a specifically windy habitat, the Bicknell thrush, correct?
Correct.
What studies support your assertion that the Bicknell thrush don't mate when it's windy?
You said mate?
Correct.
Bicknell's thrush may mate when it's very windy. They mate on the ground. So conducting flight displays when it's windy is a different issue.
But do you have any studies to support that assertion?
That Bicknell's thrushes do not conduct flight displays in windy conditions?
Yes.
No, the only this hasn't been studied in detail. This is direct observations from the Vermont Center for Eco Studies.
Okay, I'd like to move on, if I might. On page 11 of your testimony, you indicate that Druitt and Langston, 2006, have reported that small passerines are able to detect and avoid moving wind turbine blades. Do you have that report in front of you?
I can pull it up on my computer.
Okay, well, here, do you mind giving it to me?
Or if you've got one, that's fine.
I do. And if you wouldn't mind turning to there's a yellow tabby there.
Yeah, in the middle somewhere.
And you'll see a highlighted area.
Okay.
You state that small passerines are able to detect and avoid moving wind turbine blades, and you refer to that study. Could you find for me, I'm going to suggest that actually doesn't say that in the report. Do you recall offhand where it might say that?
Let's see.
Is it possible that you're misreferencing that and that actually the report says nocturnally migrating waterfowl are able to detect and avoid turbines?
That's possible. I'd like to look at this.
Okay, well, I'll move on.
Okay.
That report on page 40 also says, where at all possible, developers should avoid areas supporting the following: breeding, wintering, or migrating populations of less abundant species, particularly those of conservation concern, which may be sensitive to increased mortality as a result of collision. Developers should avoid, wherever possible, concentrations of vulnerable species. Correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. I want to touch on this question of the available Bicknell's thrush habitat. You indicate in your testimony on page 4 that Bicknell's thrush have been documented in regenerating clear cuts, and as we've seen this morning, and that this may increase the amount of available habitat by an additional 98,000 acres. What documented cases demonstrate Bicknell's thrush breeding successfully in regenerating clear cuts in Maine?
Bicknell's thrush has not been carefully studied in regenerating forest in Maine. So there is no documentation that...
Thank you. Does your estimate of the available habitat include clear cuts below 3,000 feet?
Yes.
Isn't it likely that regenerating clear cuts below 3,000 feet are likely to be of lower quality?
Well, since it hasn't been studied, I just have to say we don't know.
Okay. On page 4 of your testimony, you've referenced Lambert to support your assertion that there may be 98,000 additional acres of Bicknell's thrush habitat. Doesn't Lambert specifically advise using caution in the application of the model in areas north of 45 degrees latitude?
Yes.
And is the 98,000 acres that you reference above the 45 degrees latitude?
I'm not sure.
You're not sure. Doesn't the Lambert study doesn't actually go as far to say that this is potential habitat, does it?
The Lambert study doesn't say that, but the study from New Brunswick certainly demonstrates that, and our observations confirm that in Maine.
Okay. As in regard to New Brunswick and Quebec, Thick-nailed thrush are known to breed at lower elevations, but that's not surprising since thick-nailed thrush follow a northern gradient. So as they move northward, they do breed at lower elevations. But that wouldn't necessarily be the case in this particular site.
Well, it isn't quite that simple, and that thick-nailed thrush have bred at sea level along the coast of Maine as well as further north. So on the Gaspé Peninsula and some of the adjoining islands, they nest at sea level. They have nested at sea level here. That's true in relation to the general picture for mountaintops.
So the studies that you show, the studies that you refer to are focusing on New Brunswick and Quebec. Is that not true?
Correct.
And those locations, they do tend to be found at lower elevations.
Correct.
On page 12 of your testimony, you have a figure or a graph showing extensive area of clear cutting around the project area, which captions many of these regenerating clear cuts provide potential habitat for thick-nailed thrush. In reality, only a small portion would be the right age, condition, and high enough in elevation to be suitable, correct?
A proportion of them. We don't know how much of that is.
Right, but certainly not all of it.
Not all of it. And potential habitat doesn't mean that it's being used at this day and time, but it will be. It is something that will be available to birds over a period of time.
Okay. Now, you also reference Rimmer as being someone that you highly respect, is very knowledgeable in the area of thick-nailed thrush.
Correct.
Are you familiar with the Rimmer's thick-nailed thrush conservation strategy? Susan Gallo referenced it in her direct testimony.
I think so.
Okay. Would you be surprised to know that in that study, in the section referred to as minimization and mitigation of management impacts, says habitat alterations should be avoided in areas where natural disturbances, either chronic or random, could maintain suitable habitat for thick-nailed thrushes? Such areas include west-facing slopes, ridgelines, fir waves, and areas adjacent to fir waves?
Yes.
Okay. You would be surprised to hear that?
No.
Okay. So Rimmer, the expert, is saying that we should stay away from west-facing slopes.
Rimmer is saying that those areas should be avoided under all possible circumstances. It would be preferable, yeah.
Thank you. Given this new information that you've presented about the availability of new potential habitat, have scientists, leading experts in the field, started to pursue surveys and regenerating clear cuts in Maine? Have the VCE started surveys in those locations?
To my knowledge, the Vermont Center for Eco Studies has not started studies in these areas. I do know that they are very interested in them.
But they haven't started any.
They have not started
them. I also wanted to, you didn't touch on it in your direct, but I briefly wanted to touch on your discussion about the male flight patterns on page 10 of your testimony. You suggest that during mating season, male thick-nailed thrush fly overhead to heights of 50 to 100 feet and possibly as high as 150 feet. And again, this is based on personal conversation, and then circle ahead giving their flight songs. You also come to the conclusion that because the turbine blades won't go any lower than 119 feet, it's unlikely the males will interact with the turbine blades because the flight displays are usually beneath the height of the blade. Is that correct?
Correct.
Doesn't the species account in Birds of North America, Rimmer et al., referred in our Susan Gallo's testimony, say that flight songs typically consist of 10 to 15 second flights, 25 to 75 meters, or that's 82 to 246 feet above the ground, often in large circles?
Yeah, I think that's what the BNA account says, yeah.
Okay. So, and that's a reliable source?
Well, it's no more reliable than the source that I cited, because those are observational and not measured data. So that was an educated guess.
Okay. Well, let's go. So even if we're basing it only on the personal conversation you had with Rimmer, Remmer indicated that they do go as high as 150 feet.
Correct.
So there's still, that's still 150 feet is still above 119 feet.
Correct.
And they fly around in large circles as great as 100 meters.
Something like that, yeah.
So the chances of the Bicknell's thrush interacting with the turbine blade is significantly greater than you imply in your testimony. Is that not correct?
No, I don't think that's, I don't think so. I think unlikely is correct. That yes, you can say that by area there is the potential for interaction. The potential for mortality, I assert, is very small.
Despite the fact that they fly above 119 feet in a large circle at dusk when it's difficult to see?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. I have one last question. In regard to the comments about the ice age in your summary of your direct, and you indicate that they'll be stressed by climate change, but they'll probably adapt. Are you suggesting that any migrating species around today that had made it through the ice age will be likely to adapt to severe climate change?
Well, I'm suggesting from my study, my reading and knowledge of Bicknell's thrush, that Bicknell's thrush will adapt to climate change.
I'm sorry, but I'm just trying to take that to another level and.
So yeah, and I'm not willing to go there because I haven't thought carefully about every migratory species.
Thank you.
All right, this is Dave Public over again, and these questions are for Dr. Hudson. All right, as I read your testimony, it seemed to make three primary points, that this community is not particularly rare, the occurrence on CISC is not particularly important, and the impact of the project is not particularly significant. Would that be a fair characterization?
Yes.
All right. You stated in your testimony that as one moves north in Canada, this forest type becomes more common and widespread in the mountains, and significance of alpine forests exists in Quebec, Newfoundland, and Labrador. So there's lots of it in Canada. We shouldn't care about what's down here.
No, that's not what I said. Obviously, there's more of it as you go north, as you know. I was addressing the point, and perhaps I didn't do it eloquently enough, that there are a number of different ways to look at rarity, as you know. And there's a limited number of acres of available ground in the state of Maine where this forest type can grow. And in those spaces where this forest type can grow in the state of Maine, it grows quite well and has persisted for quite a long time. And so I consider that as different when thinking about rarity than a single plant that is adapted to geomorphical or geomorphological or geochemical conditions that limit where it can grow on the land. Those kinds of rarity are different for me. And that's why when I look at this forest type in the mountains, I don't think of it as rare. In fact, until I pointed out to the Critical Areas Program that it existed, it was completely overlooked by that program. And I encouraged them to allow me to map it in my reports because I thought that they should know about it and pay attention to it.
But in terms of, you could, the statement you've made could almost say the same thing about Canada lynx or loons. There's lots of Canada lynx and loons in Canada.
That's not the issue.
Correct?
Yes, there are.
And we care about Canada lynx and loons in Maine.
We do.
Okay. In terms of this community that's in Quebec, Newfoundland, and Labrador, some of it would be on higher mountain areas, such as Long Range, but much of it would be lower elevation.
Yeah, that's the experience I've had.
So it's in some ways it's somewhat different than these mountaintop examples that probably wouldn't be subject to the same type of wind disturbance regime, correct?
Yes, the wind effects in most of the places, although not in all of the places, decreases with elevation.
All right. Now, the Natural Areas Program lists 19 documented occurrences of this community, and you put that list up in your direct testimony. And you listed 15 additional areas where you say this community occurs. And you estimated that these additional areas might encompass approximately 8,000 acres, something.
Yeah.
And I think that's a fair estimate. So in addition to the 40,000 acres that's documented, we have an additional 8,000. That means that instead of making up 0.2% of the landscape, it makes up 0.24% of the landscape. Do you consider something that makes up 0.25% of Maine's landscape to be common?
Well, again, you and I are looking at this differently, and there, as I made clear in my testimony, this forest type is limited to mountains, and that's where you're going to find it. And it has persisted there for thousands of years, and the impacts of this project do not threaten it in the state.
All right. Of the 15 additional occurrences that you listed, how many of them are smaller than Sisk?
Half, I think, perhaps.
I would agree with that. I did pretty much the same thing you did, looked at areas above 3,000 feet as kind of a proxy for this community, and I found that 8 of those 15 were smaller than Sisk. So on the list of occurrences that was in my testimony, Sisk is pretty much in the middle of the size range for these occurrences.
Yes.
And these additional areas listed, it would still be pretty much in the middle.
Yes.
And that quite a few of the occurrences at the lower end of the list are significantly smaller than Sisk, less than 100 acres, even a few tens of acres.
Yes.
All right. So do you think it's fair to say that even though Sisk may not be the best of the best in terms of occurrences of this community, it's certainly not the worst of the worst. It's in the middle of the size range. It's a good quality occurrence. It's essentially undisturbed and natural in its condition. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, I'd say that's fair. And again, I'm, as you recall from my testimony, I'm referring to, I'm thinking about the entirety of the vegetation type in the state in making that comment, that statement, not just the Boundary Mountains.
All right. You stated that the vast majority of this forest type north and south of us in Maine and New England is permanently protected. How much of this community within the Boundary Mountains is permanently
protected? I don't have the information about what ridges may have been permanently excluded from wind development as per agreements between the state and the developers. So I can't answer that question.
Okay, I believe the answer to be none. Now, the map that accompanies your testimony, also other testimony, indicates that about 30%, almost 30% of this community occurrence would be either eliminated or directly or indirectly impacted by the project. And again, I want to follow up on what Commissioner Hilton was asking. How much of this community occurrence would have to be impacted before your testimony would change and you would consider it to have a significant undue inverse adverse impact?
I can't answer that question because I haven't looked at the, I haven't considered it. I considered this specific project and I've looked at the information for a little more than a little less than a year as the layout has changed and people have shown me different layouts. So it's very specific. My testimony is very specific to this proposal and not to a hypothetical proposal. And I don't know where you are trying to get me there with that question, but I really can't answer it.
this is the question that the commission is struggling with, where to draw the line. And, you know, we've made our case as to where we think the line should be drawn, and I just wanted to know where you drew the
well,
line.
Well, for this project, I've drawn the line where I've drawn it.
Okay. One last question. Dylan is going to show you a picture. This was included with my pre-filed testimony. It's a picture of one of the turbine pads at the Kibbe project. Is it your testimony that this type of impact is equivalent to a moose thrashing around in the woods?
Close.
All right. I'm going to pass the microphone on to Kathy Johnson, I believe.
Thank you. And I'll be asking some questions to Ms. Visserine. Louder. You all set?
Yes, I am.
Okay, here we go. Just to orient us about what we're talking about here, this is your photo simulation from viewpoint 5A. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And so Jen's just going to be a human billboard here and hold this so we can refer to it when we need to. Would you agree that the human eye is not just like a camera lens, that in fact the human eye, when you're looking at a landscape, is drawn to something that's incongruous in the landscape?
I think the human eye is very sharp and certainly notices changes in the landscape or something that does have a contrast.
Right. So if you're looking at an area and you see something like a wind tower,
and I would,
your eye is going to be drawn to it, correct?
Well, I would not characterize it necessarily as incongruous. That's your word, but it, because they're white, they do stand out. I mean, they create a contrast in the landscape,
right.
And they will be seen. They certainly will be seen,
and they
will
draw
be noticed.
Eyes.
Yes.
In your report on page 10, if you have it, you can look at it, but I'm sure you know it, you stated that the turbines would not be prominent features since they would be set behind dominant foreground landforms. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And I believe you testified in your summary today that you have read Mr. Palmer's report?
Yes.
Mr. Palmer, the consultant for the Land Use Regulation Commission.
Yes.
And in his report, referring to your statement that they would not be a dominant feature, he states, quote, "The veracity of this assertion is undermined by the simulation at viewpoint 5 on Long Pond, where the turbines are most certainly, quote, prominent." By any definition, and may be considered collectively, quote, dominant, close quote. Is that correct?
He did say that.
Yes. And are you also aware that he says in his report that it seems reasonable to assert that the turbines in the photo simulations from viewpoints 4 and 6 also are, quote, prominent, close quote?
He did say that.
And are you further aware that Mr. Palmer noted that, quote, some would also consider the turbines in the simulations from viewpoints 1 and 3 as, quote, prominent, close quote? That's on page 8 of his report.
Yes, he did say that.
No.
Does this one work?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Mr. Palmer, in his report, also critiqued your photo simulations. He stated that the contrast of the turbines in the photo simulations from viewpoints 4, 5, and 6 is unacceptably low. Having lower contrast would make the turbines harder to visualize, wouldn't it? Because they would blend in.
I do not agree with him on that, but. Having the lower contrast, the turbines are in those photo simulations. We tend to exaggerate the turbines and how they appear because they in natural atmospheric conditions, if you match the background, they will not show up as well. So we try to make them look a little more prominent than they would if you mimicked the background background in the photo simulation.
But Mr. Palmer, in looking at your photo simulation, did make the observation that the contrast was lower. And so, in fact, the turbines visible from this point would be more visible than your photo simulation would have us believe. Isn't that correct?
He did. I do not agree with him.
Pisgah and Sisk Mountains are both pointed mountains, aren't they?
Yes.
And the ridge that wind towers are primarily proposed for is a long ridge that basically kind of stretches between them as you're looking at it, let's say, from Chain of Ponds, correct?
It's actually heading up to the north. It's not heading between them, it appears to be, in that particular view. But it is a relatively flat ridge and slightly undulating, yes.
So when you're, for instance, sitting in a canoe on Chain of Ponds and looking up to the northeast or whatever the exact direction is, you'll see a pointed Mount Pisgah on the left and a pointed Sisk Mountain on the right, and what appears to be between them is this flat ridge on which the towers will sit, correct?
Yes, you would see it from that particular vantage point. You would see that mountain in between.
Yes,
the two peaks.
And your eyes are going to be drawn to the turbines instead of to the ospreys and the eagles and the falcons and so forth that are flying around because they stretch across the field in front of you, and you're looking to that direction. Correct?
I think there's the turbines will certainly be noticeable, but I feel, and as I pointed out in my testimony, the eye is drawn to many things in the landscape, and those mountains are as much a focal point as the turbines will be, as well as other things that one sees around the pond. Because one is in the pond, not in one position, looking, as we are right now, at this particular situation, but moving through that landscape. And oh. they will certainly be noticeable, yeah. But I don't think they are going to be the dominant element in the landscape. I think that those foreground peaks, because they are higher, closer, you can see the details in them, they are going to be just as noticeable, if not more so, and even
thank you.
In this position.
I think we've got the point. And there are five ponds that make up the Chain of Ponds, correct?
That's right.
And Long Pond and Bag Pond are in the middle, correct?
Yes.
And it's actually, so those are the most natural appearing of the ponds. The road doesn't come near the shore of either Long Pond or Bag Pond, correct?
It's audible, but it's not visible from those ponds.
Okay. Now, your viewpoint 5A here also purports to show what the roads associated with the proposal would look like, correct?
Yes.
And have you seen the now constructed roads at Kibby?
Yes.
And you've seen where they had to blast significant bedrock to make the roads?
Yes.
And you've seen where they had to fill significantly to level the road out?
Yes.
The distance where the road would be visible on Sisk Mountain is approximately 1 mile, give or take, what's shown on your from Chain of Ponds.
It would in terms of the total length. I mean, it comes in and out of view depending on where the fill slopes would be located. Mm-hmm. You would be seeing some intermittent areas.
Okay,
of,
across a 1 mile stretch, give or take, intermittently.
It's probably about that kind of distance. Yes.
And are you aware that the slopes across which that road would travel are apparently 30% to 40% slopes?
Yes, they are very steep slopes. They vary in steepness from. I think some of them are probably steeper than that.
And are you aware then that some of the cutting that may take place might go as high as 70 feet above the road surface, and some of the fill might go down 30 feet, give or take?
There
so
are,
you might have up to 100 feet of cut.
There are a few places where that will occur, yes. Yeah.
And that will make them very visible, isn't that right?
Well, they won't be seen in the same way we saw them up at Kibbe, because we're going to be looking at a very different vantage point.
But they're going to be, you would agree, they're significantly more visible than is apparent in this photo simulation,
well,
which doesn't simulate any cut and fill at all.
Yes, it does. We showed where the cut and fill, we calculated based on the grading plan that was proposed, where the cut and fill, are you looking at, is this, I can't see from here, but if this is the one that shows the roads in it?
Yeah. Take my word for it. You can't really visualize it. Anyway, let's move on. Just another couple questions. According to Appendix 2, which is the map that's included in your testimony, some number of the 15 turbines would be visible along the entire length of Long Pond. Is that correct?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that question?
Sure. In the map, in your testimony showing where along the chain of ponds you would be able to get views of some number of turbines?
Yes.
You can see them along the entire length of Long Pond, correct? Some number. One in some, or two or three in some places, going up to 10 or so?
The southern shore, yes. Most of the northern shore, you would not see any.
Okay. But if you're paddling down the length of the pond, if you're out on the water, you can see the turbines along the entire length of the pond, correct?
Well, if you were paddling along the northern shore, no, you probably wouldn't see them at all. But if you were paddling along the southern shore, you would see them along.
And if you're paddling in the middle of the pond, you would see them also.
You would see some turbines, yes, fewer than in our simulations, but yes.
Yep. And you would also see them from the western half of Bag Pond and from the southern end of Natanis Pond, correct?
You would see them from the southwest little bay of Bag Pond, and from Natanis, you would see them, yes, from this very small area along the southeast end of Natanis, yes.
And I believe you stated that you would see them then approximately, I think you said, just around a third of the distance of the chain of ponds.
A little under a third,
31%,
yes.
I think, is exactly what your testimony says. If instead of, if you actually were only looking for the northern eight turbines, you would see them from a small, much smaller stretch of the chain of ponds. Isn't that right?
From the northern turbines?
If you're only looking at
the northern turbines, you would be seeing them from probably about half of Long Pond and just the northern ones. You would also be seeing them from that section in Bag Pond. So, yeah, the only.
So would you agree with me that you would see, if you were only looking at the northern eight turbines, you'd only see them for about 10% of the distance instead of 31%?
No, I wouldn't agree.
How much of the distance do you believe you would see them, the northern turbines from?
You would see the northern turbines for most of that area on the view shed that is shown in the red and the yellow. So that's a large section of Long Pond, and you would see them from the section that was the Bag Pond section. So the only place that you would we're focusing on you would see the northern turbines from quite a bit of chain of ponds.
Okay. I'd like to move on now to Mr. Titus.
Yeah, you can. Thank you, Jen.
Mr. Titus, you stated that you did the scoping document and first draft of the plan for the chain of ponds unit. Is that correct?
Yes.
The so-called first draft that you did was actually something that the folks at BPL call a pre-plan document. Isn't that correct?
The scoping and pre-plan would have been the same thing. And then from there, I had created an initial draft, or what we would call a first draft.
Isn't it more accurate to describe the pre-plan document that you prepared more like an inventory than any sort of a plan?
In it also was included some management issues in regards to the chain of ponds unit and the other properties within the Flagstaff region.
In fact, the Bureau of Parks and Lands doesn't even do this stage of pre-planned document because they found it wasn't useful. Isn't that correct?
I am not aware of that.
Okay. So the work that you did, it was prior to any advisory committee being set up. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And there was no vision for the lands in the pre-planned document?
That's right.
And there are no conclusions about management priorities in the pre-plan document?
Right. That was saved for the initial draft, the first
draft. And in fact, there was no vision or conclusions about management priorities while you were working on the plan before you were handed it over to another staff person at BPL.
Yeah. Like I had said, from the scoping plan, I had drafted what we would call a first draft or an initial draft, and at that point, that's when it was handed to another individual to finish.
Now, I assume that you have reviewed the final plan that,
yes,
that was prepared by other staff.
Right.
You're aware that the very first three words of the description of Chain of Ponds is that it's a highly scenic area?
Yes.
And that there is a quote in the very first paragraph that, quote, there are few places in Maine with as rugged a landscape, mountain summits and ridges surround the narrow ribbon of water and create a fjord-like setting. That's correct, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, that's correct.
And in the recreation section of that plan, the very first sentence in the recreation section says, quote, recreational use of this area consists of camping at the Bureau's primitive campsites on Long and Bag Pond and at the commercial campground on Natanas Pond, canoeing and kayaking and fishing, correct?
That's correct.
And they further go on to talk about, quote, carry in access to the two middle ponds within the chain, correct?
That's correct also.
And they also talk about, quote, primitive camping is available at several locations on the pond.
That is also correct.
And when you get to management concerns and issues in the pond, in the plan, it talks about additional primitive campsites may be appropriate on Long and Bag ponds.
Yes.
And that's because I believe, as you said in your testimony, that these are campsites that are very heavily used.
They tend to be
very popular.
From time to time, yes.
Very popular. And you, I believe you also mentioned that one of the management issues is to work with the commercial campground lessee to ensure that the campground is, quote, in character with the scenic and primitive nature of the surroundings.
Yes.
Is that correct? Isn't it true that the management plan talks about the draw of this area for most recreationists being its, quote, wild and scenic character, close quote?
I do not agree with that assessment, no.
Do you have the management plan handy?
I do have one, yes.
Would you like to look at page 31? Do you have page 31 there? Would you read the sentence that's highlighted in that plan?
Certainly. Overall, the draw of this area for most recreationists is its wild and scenic character.
Thank you. And the vision and the management policies for this region as a whole, the Flagstaff region, of which Chain of Ponds is one, begins, quote, the Bureau lands are signature landscapes that draw visitors to the region in search of a remote recreation experience, close quote. And it speaks specifically of camping on the sandy beaches of Chain of Ponds. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the fact that BPL's management decision to add additional primitive campsites shows that they're managing this area for primitive recreation. Isn't that right?
I would not agree with that statement, no.
Okay. There are no recommendations in the management plan for management activities to increase intensive motorized uses, are there?
That's correct.
So your assertion that there was a management decision to manage Chain of Ponds primarily, that's your word, for intensive motorized uses is not accurate, is it?
I believe that it is accurate.
Have you ever paddled on long or bag ponds?
I have. I've not paddled. I have been out on the ponds, however.
Have you been on long and bag pond?
Yes, I have.
But you haven't paddled?
No. Okay.
I have a couple questions for Mr. Seltzer.
Kathy, I'm down to about 4 minutes left.
Yep, because, I got about
okay.
4 minutes worth.
All right.
I'm right on top of it.
You're doing great.
Thank you. I think we're going to come in just under the wire. Mr. Seltzer, in your testimony, you extensively addressed LIRC's comprehensive land use plan. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Are you aware that LIRC's comprehensive land use plan is not a regulatory criterion in this development application?
That's actually not correct, no. In all development applications, the applicant must consider all of LIRC's plans and regulations and LIRC's primary planning document upon which all of its regulations are based is the CLUP.
And the CLUP that you referred to in your plan is the recently adopted CLUP, which is not the one which actually applies to this proceeding, is that correct?
It is our position that the 2010 CLUP applies to this proceeding, but as noted in my pre-file testimony, both versions of the CLUP are equally support this project. In fact, the energy resources goal from the 1997 CLUP to the 2010 CLUP is virtually unchanged.
I have a few questions for Mr. Williamson. Thank you. Mr. Williamson, in your testimony, you assert that the project won't adversely affect recreational users, correct?
Yes, I do.
But all of the anecdotes in your testimony purportedly showing that their recreational users won't be impacted relate to the construction of Kibbe 1. Is that correct?
I'm not sure if that's the case or not.
Would you agree? Would you take my word for it? I looked carefully, and they all related to Kibbe 1? As you represent them in your testimony?
Well, the two projects are very closely related, so. Okay.
In fact, I couldn't find any testimony with any specific information about the potential impacts of the Kibbe expansion project on recreational users in the area. Is that correct?
Well, I guess what I would say is that the information in my testimony, I think, is important to the commission as far as the people in the clubs that I've spoken to in the area and how they use the area.
But it doesn't directly relate to the potential impacts of this particular project.
Well, I would say that the original Kibbe project and this expansion are very closely related, and the area is very proximate, so that it does actually relate to the Kibbe expansion.
In your testimony, you also stated that there's been significant interest in viewing the Kibbe wind project. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Lots of folks going out there having a look?
Absolutely.
But just because there's a lot of interest in the project doesn't suggest what people think about the project after they see it, does it?
Well, I will tell you that when I bring people up there, they think that it's attractive, including your board.
But the fact that some people, including our board members, because we're very supportive of wind power and supported the Kibbe project, like the Kibbe project, doesn't suggest for a second that all the people who go up there like the project.
No, sure, some people object to how wind power looks.
And I assume that you're not also suggesting that the fact that people who view the project and like what they see, that somehow substitutes for the adverse impacts that this project might have on recreational users on Long Pond or Bag Pond who are looking for a natural experience.
Well, I don't believe that there will be adverse impacts to people enjoying the chain of ponds.
In your discussion of the recreational impacts of the Kibbe project, you mentioned the impacts on the snowmobile club trail system, the ATV trails, hunters and fishing and trapping opportunities, correct?
Correct.
In your testimony, you failed to even mention the chain of ponds, a resource of statewide
outstanding scenic importance. Isn't that right?
Well, I believe I mentioned that John Titus was focusing more on that.
Right. But you didn't mention it in yours.
I did not.
In terms of recreational impacts. And you failed in your testimony to even mention an entire set of recreational users, those families and individuals who come to the chain of ponds to paddle on the ponds, to fish, to watch wildlife, or to camp in the primitive campsites. You didn't even mention them, did you?
Well, I guess I did not mention them in my testimony, but I would say that I have spent quite a bit of time talking with Sharon and Ken Thomas, and there won't be impacts from that part of the chain of ponds where most people experience the chain of ponds.
And are you aware that the Bureau of Parks and Lands, in their management plan, as I was just discussing with Mr. Titus, focuses on improving opportunities for primitive recreation users on chain of ponds, making more hand-carry launch sites, making primitive campsites? Are you aware of that?
I have not reviewed that plan in detail.
Okay, thank you. I think we're done, unless you guys... We're done.
Good, thank you very much. I do appreciate, it seems like we're getting some good... concise answers and questions here, and that's great. Next is cross-examination by the Friends of Boundary Mountains. Okay, so...
Is Christine Cinnamon, Jeff Seltzer, Toby Williamson, Vickery, Dana Velo, Terry Bennett, John Titus, Christine Simmons.
Okay, so we're talking, we're going to go to about 12:40. I think Bobby mentioned you thought you could do it in less than that, but. Sounds like 3 minutes recess.
I figured I'd try and.
But if you need it, you take it.
Okay, well, it sounded like.